Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with David Barsamyan, who will be in Santa Fe at the CCA tonight, talking about revolutions in the Middle East and South Asia. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Temple Grandin. She's a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She's the author of many books, including Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. She will be giving a lecture this Friday, March 11th, in the gymnasium at the Student Activities Center at St. John's College at 8 in the evening, titled Autism, Animals, and Different Ways of Thinking. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here.
So you grew up with autism, and you have made a brilliant case that autism can actually be advantageous because it's a different way of thinking and seeing and feeling that opens up a person's senses and abilities in a different way than so-called neurotypical people.
Well, I want to emphasize autism is a very big spectrum. And
right.
A little bit of autism gives you the brilliant people out of Silicon Valley that bring you computers, brought you the engineers that make it possible for this radio station to work. I've been out to Hollywood. There's producers out there that make great movies that I know have a little touch of autism. So a little bit of that trait, you know, you can get some advantages, especially cognitive advantages. You know, disconnect some of the social circuits. You can get geek circuits to do all kinds of really great geek stuff. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you're going to have severe autism. And they are not going to be working at Silicon Valley. They're going to be nonverbal and have a lot of problems. So autism is a true continuous trait, you know, from being a little bit geeky down to somebody who's going to remain nonverbal that will have to live in a supervised situation for the rest of their life.
Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, I'm certainly on the high end of the spectrum now, but when I was a child, when I was 2.5, 3 years old, I had the symptoms that were quite severe, no speech, and constantly rocking and things like that. And then you have the kids they label Asperger's, and these are the kids where there's no speech delay. And another name for these kids is just geeks and nerds. And one of the things I think that's hurting some of these geeky, nerdy kids that ought to be headed out for Silicon Valley or doing art or doing some other really good thing is today's social rules are much looser. When I was a child, I was taught table manners. I was taught I had to sit through church. I was taught to be on time. That's the way kids were brought up in the 50s. And that actually was really good for me. But then on the other hand, my mother always encouraged my ability in art. And she always encouraged me to do pictures of lots of different things. Like I used to like to draw horses. Well, she said, why don't you draw a beach? And then she framed the beach in a real professional frame. You know, always try to broaden out the skill.
You have described the way you saw the world when you were a child, and you didn't realize that other people didn't see and feel the way you did. What was it like for you? What were your senses like?
All of my thinking is in pictures, and I thought everybody thought in pictures. And then in the mid-90s, I wrote my book, Thinking in Pictures, and I was shocked to find out that a lot of people don't think in pictures. Like, for example, if I say think about a church steeple, most people see this sort of vague, generalized one. I just see specific ones. But I also want to emphasize that not everybody on the autism spectrum is a visual thinker. I'm a photorealistic visual thinker. I absolutely couldn't do algebra. And I'm finding kids that can't do algebra, but they can do geometry and they can do trigonometry. Another kind of mind is a pattern thinker. Think a more abstract visual thinker. Think origami. Think organic chemistry, molecules. Think chess. And these kids are the kids that are really going to be good at engineering. They're going to be really good at things like doing computer programming. And a lot of these little kids have trouble with reading. There's uneven skills. And then a third type is kind of a word thinker. They definitely prefer words, and they know tons and tons of facts about their favorite subject. You know, the autistic mind tends to be a specialist mind, good at one thing and really bad at something else. And what we got to do is take that child's strengths and build up on it.
You think in pictures. You've also written many books. You have a PhD. You're a professor. What was the process like for you of learning to articulate your ideas in language?
Well, you get better and better. People are always looking for a single magic turning point. And when I was much younger, I much preferred, typing and writing than I did talking. And when I gave some of my very first talks in graduate school, my very first one, I did a panicked and I walked out. There's no single magic turning point. See, a person on the autism spectrum is a bottom-up thinker. The way I form a concept is I have to take lots of specific examples and put them in a file folder. Like maybe this file folder, I put all the dog examples in. You know, and they say, dog, I don't see a generic dog. I'm seeing specific dogs. Say, church steeple, I'm seeing specific ones. If you say factory, I'm seeing specific factories. There's no factory concept in my head.
Very interesting. So there's a lot of these, as you call them, geeky kids that are falling through the cracks right now, because not only because they don't learn social skills, but because they're not understood. There aren't necessarily enough art classes anymore, hands-on classes. So
I am very concerned about taking out the hands-on classes, because it was my science teacher that did hands-on things that really saved me. There's a scene in the HBO movie, which incidentally is out on DVD now, and he showed me a movie where I got to see this really neat optical illusion room. And then I spent 6 months trying to build the optical illusion room. And what I'm seeing now is I'm seeing a lot of smart, geeky kids getting so addicted to video games that they're just going nowhere. And they're not learning how to program video games, because I just read an article in the paper that the video game industry is short on programmers right now. You know, the thing is, programming video games is hard work. And to learn a skill like that requires some mentoring. Kids just don't walk into the local Barnes & Noble or some other bookstore and load up on high-level computer books unless they have some mentoring.
When you talk about they're playing too many video games, I would think that's dangerous, because as you write about, autistic kids tend to get really fixated on one thing.
Well, the problem is they're playing video games and they're not learning work skills. When I was in high school, I went to a special boarding school, and for about 3 years I didn't do any studying, but I learned a lot of work skills. I took care of 9 horses. My mother had me go out to this ranch, and I actually built that gate that you could open up from the car. You know, these were, I was learning work skills. I'm seeing smart, geeky kids. They've never delivered a paper, and I think it's a shame there's no more paper routes, because I put all these kids at 13 on paper routes because they got to learn. You got to do it every day. You got to do it on time. Well, the new paper route for some of these 13-year-olds is dog walking, you know, because a lot of cities have leash laws, and you're going to have to walk them every day. You know, there's some discipline there that, you know, that middle schoolers need to learn on how to work. And if there's no paper route, let's do dog walking. Let's do fixing computers. Let's do making PowerPoint presentations for people. You've got to start doing stuff, you know, learning how to do stuff for other people that other people want. The other thing, as far as social skills go, I got my socialization through shared interests. And one of the shared interests I'm getting a lot of great feedback on from parents is Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. Because you work to get all those badges. It's a real structured thing, and these kids really get into that and become Eagle Scout, and that gives them a lot of confidence. But we need to be doing, you know, those kind of activities. Now, I'm not saying that we ban video games, but that needs to be limited to an hour a day.
We're talking to Temple Grandin. So you yourself were not so caught up on social relationships with people, but you had an extraordinary understanding of animals. How was your mind similar to the mind of, say, dogs, pigs, cows, other domesticated mammals?
Well, my thinking is all visual thinking. You see, normal people think in language. Animals live in a sensory world, a world of vision. Dogs live in a world of smell. But it's a sensory world, like the dog is in a world of smell detail, an auditory world. It's a sensory-based, very, very detailed world. And if you want to really understand animals, you've got to get away from language. And then I have another book, Animals in Translation, where I have a whole chapter on animal thinking.
You have designed humane slaughterhouses for cattle based on an understanding of how they move, how they think, what scares them, what calms them down. What about their lives before they're slaughtered?
Well,
for example,
we've got to give animals a good life. And beef of all the animals, when they're done right, has the best life. Because all the cows and calves are out on pasture. The mama cows are out on pasture. Mama cows are out on pasture, whether the meat goes to Whole Foods or it goes to, you know, Tyson. Mama cows are out on pasture. And beef's the most extensively raised animal. Also, as we're getting into more and more shortages, I'm getting really concerned about the corn prices and all this corn being made into fuel. I just talked to a lady in Idaho, and she told me that the potato farmers are digging up the ground and they're planting corn. But there's a lot of land in this country where the only thing you could raise on that land for food is ruminant animals. That'd be cattle, sheep, or goats. Vast amounts of land. I just drove up to Laramie, Wyoming, and you've got all this real arid land that's pasture land, and you can raise ruminants on that. And I think there needs to be a lot more research in some of these intensive grazing systems where you make domesticated animals mimic the patterns of the wild buffalo, come in, graze an area, you know, mow the grass, and then move on to another area. And you can increase the carrying capacity of the land and at the same time improve the land. Your grazing done right actually improves the land, and it's very good from a carbon cycle standpoint.
We've talked about that with the Kivira Coalition, who's working on that here in New Mexico, just exactly the things you're thinking. What about, though, these animals in concentrated feeding areas like pigs who barely get outside and cows in feedlots and so on?
Well, cows actually like to eat corn. You know, when the feed wagon comes, they come running. It's junk food, but they love it. They gobble it right down. You don't have to... They line her up and eat. They see that feed truck coming, they come a-running. And you know, if you feed corn right, there isn't a welfare problem because you get them slaughtered before it turns into a health problem, because it is basically a diet of high carbs, but they love to eat it. And there's only one reason why corn is fed to cattle. It's because it's cheap. But now corn is no longer cheap. I mean, I'm just shocked at how expensive corn's gotten. And a very, very high percentage of our corn crop now is going into ethanol. And, you know, if that trend continues, we're going to be finding a lot more cattle being put back out on pasture.
Interesting. Now, do you relate, I mean, as an autistic person, and you've written about this, autistic people don't relate so much to social activities with other kids or with other adults. But what about animals? Do you relate to animals the way somebody else might relate to friends?
Well, I really like animals you know, I used to like to get out in the pasture and let the cows just come up, you know, and sniff you because they're curious. You know, one some of the first work that I ever did with cattle, it was back in the early 70s, and I noticed that when the cattle were going through the chutes to get vaccinated, that they were afraid of things like a coat on a fence, a shadow, a reflection on metal, a reflection off the bumper of a truck, seeing people up ahead. And if you got rid of these distractions, they'd walk right up the chute. And then another question I always have got to answer for people is, do the animals know they're going to get slaughtered? Well, I'd go over to the local swift plant and watch them go up the chute. Then I'd go out to a feed yard or a ranch and watch them go up the chute there. They behave the same way in both places. If they knew they were going to get slaughtered, they ought to be a whole lot wilder at the slaughterhouse than at the ranch getting their vaccinations. You know, if you get rid of the stuff they're scared of, like it's too dark or there's a shiny reflection, you know, then they walk right in.
Yeah, you told a story about this very expensive facility that was built, and the cows wouldn't go into it, and they were going to tear it down and build a new one, and you just opened the windows.
That's all I did. I just opened up a door, a big garage door on the other side, to let light into the building because they don't like to go into a dark cave, and let more light in, and then it worked just fine. You see, the animals notice little sensory things that people tend to not notice. You know, they wanted to tear up the facility. They didn't have to tear up the facility. All they had to do was get light into this building because cattle didn't want to enter this dark building. Now, somebody might say, well, maybe put electric lights in there. Well, the problem is the sun's 100 times brighter than any kind of normal electric light I can buy. I can use electric lights at night to attract animals into trucks and into buildings. But it doesn't work very well in the daytime. When it's real sunny outside, I've got to get light in there by opening up the walls or putting in white translucent skylights.
Now, what you are talking about with animals is the fears that they have, which people may not be aware of or may not realize or think, why would a cow be scared of a leaf or a coat? How did you come to understand that?
Well, I just watched the animal. The animal would look right at the coat. I mean, people often leave little chains hanging down in the chute, and I've seen cattle come right up to the entrance of a chute, and there's a chain swinging back and forth, and the animal's head's rocking back and forth following the chain, because it's attracting his attention. Well, if I'm trying to get him up the chute, I don't want him to just stand there watching the chain swing back and forth. The mistake that people make is then they push him, and then the cow just gets scared and turns back, because cattle have a natural tendency to want to go back to where they came from. But I find if you get rid of the chains, I've seen situations where cattle constantly backed up in the chute all the time at the slaughterhouse, and they wouldn't go in, and all you had to do was change some lighting to get rid of a reflection, and get a chain tied up, and then they would walk right in.
How did you get, not only get into this line of work, but also get people to listen to what you had to say? I guess that was a process, too.
Well, basically, you start out one customer at a time. And it's a scene in the movie where they built my curved facility, but then they wrecked the dip vat entrance by putting that metal plate in. And that actually did happen. You see, it's hard to get people to understand the principle of using behavior rather than force. But after I got a couple of systems in, even though maybe people didn't use them always correctly, people saw that my stuff worked. And then I started writing articles in cattle magazines. Because I learned what I had to do is sell my work and not myself. When you're a geek and you don't have great social skills, you got to show off your work. So every time I designed something, I always had pictures and drawings in my notebook. Now today you can put all that stuff on your phone. And then no matter where you're at, you see the right person, you can show that to them. Because I didn't sell myself, I sold my work. And I also got a reputation very quickly for writing really good articles for our state farm magazine. You know, and people could count on me that when I covered the Arizona Cattle Feeders meeting, I did not misquote people.
We're talking to Temple Grandin. I know that you work more with cattle than with domestic dogs, but we have so many listeners who are dog owners. What should people know about their dogs?
First of all, if you've got a behavior problem, you need to try to figure out, is it fear motivated? I mean, a lot of people are getting rescues, and you'll have a lot of problems with fear. I talk about that extensively in my book, Animals in Translation. And animals can get fear memories, like a dog might get afraid of a raised-up newspaper because he'd been hit with it. Or maybe he's afraid of a particular type of shoe because when somebody beat him up, he was looking right at that, this type of loafers or sneaker, whatever kind of shoe it was. So they can get fear memories that are either sound, the sound of a certain kind of voice, or maybe the dog's afraid of guys because the guys had beaten it up. They get fear memories, and these fear memories are not verbal. They're specific, like a picture or a certain sound. There was an elephant that was terrified of diesel-powered equipment. Boy, if it ran with a diesel engine, it was scary. If it ran with a gas engine, then it was safe because somebody had probably attacked it with construction equipment. It's sensory-based, and it's very important in working with animals. You've got to figure out, when you have a behavior problem, what is motivating it. Is it fear? Is it aggression? And the other problem in trying to figure out behavior problems is people are way too vague. You see, when you think in language, you tend to be really vague. I've had people say to me, well, my dog goes berserk. Well, what does that mean? If I got a little dog and he's really happy to see me when I get back home and he's jumping all around and wagging his tail, you might call that going berserk. Or maybe he just bit me. Maybe I call that going berserk. You know, I find I have to question people, both when I'm trying to figure out an animal behavior problem and maybe a behavior problem with, you know, a child with autism. You don't just tell me he's got behavior issues in the classroom. You've got to tell me exactly what he's doing. You know, don't be vague. And one of the things that frustrates me is a normal human mind tends to be vague. And I've been on a lot of boards where I've been writing guidelines for animal welfare and figuring out auditing systems, is people write vague stuff like handle them properly, give them sufficient space. What does that mean? Or you got to put or they got to have pasture access. Well, what's pasture access? You've got to be more specific. What's pasture? When does a piece of ground get so overgrazed that it turns into non-pasture? You're going to have to define things. And I find that when when I think in pictures and I think about a pasture, I'm seeing pastures. I'm seeing a pasture now that's all green. I'm seeing a dirt lot with no grass on it. I'm seeing a dirt lot with like two blades of grass, and somebody might try to call that a pasture, but it's not. You know, I'm seeing it in pictures.
And as you've written, animals see things very specifically. So a cow or a horse will differentiate between a person with a white hat and a black hat. And if a person with a black hat abused them, they're not going to be scared of the white-hatted person.
That's absolutely correct. But they might get afraid of a large black purse that's about the same size as a black cowboy hat, especially if the purse is put up near the person's head, because that's something that might kind of approximate the image of the hat. So then you can get situations where you're getting odd fear things popping back, and it doesn't seem to be rational. You know, or maybe a black neck pillow. You had a black neck pillow around your neck. That might look a little bit like a black cowboy hat. So you might get afraid of that. Now, a white neck pillow would be fine, but some other object is sort of round and the sort of the same shape as a cowboy hat.
And for a cow, a person on a horse is a different animal than that same person off the horse.
That's right. Now, I think it's very important to train cattle that tolerate both people on horses and people on the ground, because I've seen a very dangerous situation where the cattle are handled strictly on horseback, and they have a 2-foot flight zone. They're very tame when the guy is on the horse. But then if the person walks into the pasture, the cattle scatter. Now they have a 50-foot flight zone. Well, that gets very dangerous when they go to an auction market or they go into a slaughter plant where you now have them in a small pen, and somebody walks in the small pen, you're deep in the flight zone. The cattle are getting all fearful and freaking out, and they run back by you trying to get away. And there's been people knocked over and some very, very serious accidents.
For people who have autistic children or teach autistic children, what are some of the main things that they should know and that they should do?
Well, for little kids, 2 and 3 years old, if you've got a little kid that's nonverbal, sitting somewhere rocking, 2 and 3-year-old little kid, the worst thing you can do is nothing. You've got to start working with these kids. You've got to get them engaged. And don't wait to get services. If you can't get services, you get some grannies, you get some students, you get some people to come in and just work with that kid. Engage him in little games. If he's twiddling a penny, then take turns with him twiddling a penny. You've got to kind of intrude in their world some. You know, sing nursery rhymes to him, get him doing little activities. The trick is you got to keep him engaged. And that was done with me. You know, get him to sit at the table. If he, you know, twirls his fork around, get him to put his fork back down on the table. You've got to engage them. And the worst thing you can do is nothing. And these kids need 20 or 30 hours a week being engaged with an effective teacher. Now, that doesn't have to be something that costs $100,000 a year. That effective teacher could be a grandmother or a high school student. And some people are effective teachers. They kind of know how to be gently insistent to get through to these autistic kids. And then you've got to be careful about sensory overload, even on the mild end of the spectrum. You know, loud noise when I was a little kid was a school bell. That was like a dentist drill hitting a nerve. That was absolutely, you know, beyond horrible. And one of the things you can do to desensitize things like the school bell is it's better tolerated if the child turns it on, or the dreaded smoke alarm. The kid may not want to go into a room because he got blasted out by a smoke alarm. Now every time he sees a smoke alarm, he's freaking out because he's afraid it's going to go off. Well, maybe one of the ways to desensitize the smoke alarm would be to get a smoke alarm, wrap it up in like 5 or 6 towels, you know, so it'll be really muffled, and then the kid can turn on the smoke alarm. You see, where the kid initiates the horrible sound, it's better tolerated, and then gradually you can take the towels off. And the only reason I'm suggesting using a real smoke alarm is that MP3 files are not full spectrum. You record it on that format, you're not going to be desensitizing right.
There's also visual desensitization. You've talked about a child who couldn't stay for more than a couple of minutes in a big box store, but then when they put on little pink sunglasses, they could stay for an hour.
Well, that's right. And one of the worst problems out in the classroom environment and the shopping environment is fluorescent lights. There are some kids on the autism spectrum and some dyslexic kids and some ADHD kids and some kids with a whole lot of other labels. And don't get hung up on these labels, because these diagnostic categories are not precise. They see the flicker of fluorescent lights like a discotheque, like a strobe light just flashing on and off. And they absolutely can't tolerate this. And sometimes if you can find just the right colored glasses, it stops. It helps this problem. And nobody knows why this works. You know, there's something wrong inside the brain with the circuits that form the visual images. There are also circuits we know where they're located, but scientists have absolutely no idea how they work. But for some unknown reason, you try on colored glasses. And the child has to pick the color that works for them. And one kid, it might be pink glasses. Another kid, it might be, you know, light blue, or it might be, you know, yellow, or it might be light lavender. Also, if you ask these kids, do you ever see the print jiggle on the page? Then you know that they've got this problem. Also, try different pastel papers, printing their homework on, and use a laptop computer. That's one screen that doesn't flicker. You know, and the iPad is probably okay. But there's some older type of computer screens that flicker, and the whole computer's like flashing on and off, and they're not going to be able to use that.
We're talking to Temple Grandin. She's a professor of animal science at Colorado State University, the author of many books. She's the subject of a film starring Claire Danes. She will be giving a lecture this Friday, March 11th, at St. John's College at 8 o'clock, titled Autism, Animals, and Different Ways of Thinking. I have one more question for you. Can autistic children learn kind of loving affection toward their parents, toward their family?
Well, yes, they can. And, you know, there's a lot of things that can be taught. You know, when I was a little kid, I didn't want to be hugged. And it was just too much overwhelming stimulation. But sometimes you can desensitize these kids by just gradually trying to hug them a bit more. But avoid little light tickle touches. Little light tickle touches set off kind of an alarm reaction. And the other thing that can sometimes help is do deep pressure. You know, I had my squeezing machine, but other simpler things you can do is just getting under a mattress. You can do things like rolling up with mats, getting underneath beanbag chairs. And sometimes doing this pressure can kind of help desensitize the nervous system. And then the child's going to like hugging a lot better. Another thing that's helped a lot of little autistic kids is riding horses, because you've got balancing and rhythmic activity going at the same time. And quite a few little kids have done their first words while riding on a horse. You also might be able to get some of this same effect by doing activities that involve balancing and rhythm. I'm a big believer in having an OT work with these kids on, you know, sensory integration methods.
Very interesting. Well, Temple Grandin, thank you very much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you on Friday night at St. John's.
Well, that'll be just great.
Excellent. And by the way, for the event at St. John's, seating is limited. It's expected to be crowded, so please come early and carpool. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program David Barsamyan. He's the producer of Alternative Radio, and he will be speaking tonight at the CCA at 7:30 on revolutions in the Middle East and South Asia. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
It's great to have you back here in the cafe. So you were just in India, you were in Kashmir, and as you were just saying before we went on the program, a great deal of attention is paid to the Middle East and very little to India. What's going on with that?
Well, there's a juggernaut of injustices in India, to paraphrase the writer and social activist Arundhati Roy, that has sparked a wave of rebellions and revolts all across the Indian subcontinent. Some of them seek freedom and independence, such as Kashmir and in the northeast area of the country, Manipur, Nagaland, and Assam. Others want to replace the government with a socialist communist regime. There's a vast rebellion going on in the central part of the country, largely composed of indigenous peoples whose lands and resources have been stolen from them. And this is called a Maoist, Naxalite rebellion. And these are, I think, amazing movements that receive scant attention, because the rhetoric here, particularly in the United States, is India is the world's largest democracy. And, you know, it's a burgeoning market. It is an emerging superpower. It's a great destination for U.S. exports. Barack Obama, when he was there in November of 2010, basically fulfilled his role as president of the United States, which is to be the CEO of corporate capitalism. He was selling U.S. wares. What wares? Armaments. And he signed a $5 billion deal for Boeing C-17 military cargo planes. So India is becoming a very important military ally of the United States as well, in terms of the U.S. positioning China as its long-term adversary. So to build up India as a strategic ally in that region is part of what the U.S. is doing. And that accounts partly for a total blackout or whiteout on what's going on inside the country. I just spent some time in Kashmir. I hadn't been there since 2007. It is a human rights nightmare. It is the most densely, it has the dubious distinction of being the most densely occupied piece of real estate on earth.
Is that right?
700,000 Indian security forces are in an area where there are about 7 million Kashmiris. The entire,
it sounds like Gaza.
It's much more than that, in fact. Gaza is occupied in a different way. It's being strangled externally. In this case, the Indian Army is an occupation force. It is seen as an occupation force. And without going into the arcane history of 1947 and the partition of India into India and Pakistan and the very controversial accession to India by the Hindu Maharaja, the Hindu king of Kashmir, today people in Kashmir have been suffering terribly. An armed revolt began in 1989. More than 70,000 people have been killed. 8,000 to 10,000 are disappeared. What is the norm there is extrajudicial executions, disappearances. You have torture that's commonplace, detention, preventative detention. Under one law that was enacted by the Indian Parliament, it allows the army or the security forces to keep people up to 2 years without charges. So it's a very desperate situation. Nevertheless, I met a lot of activists there, intellectuals, journalists, students, media workers, and others who have felt that in the last 3 years, since the Kashmir movement has morphed from an armed revolt into using civil disobedience and non-cooperation, that it has now created a space for more, let us say, more acceptance by the so-called international community.
Who is rebelling against who? What are the issues? Who are the players?
Well, the rebellion is for independence, is from either to join with Pakistan or to have an independent Kashmiri state. And the vast number of Kashmiris are in support of this. There's little debate about that. The Indian occupation has been brutal. I mean, it's almost redundant. All occupations are brutal by definition. When you have a military force policing civilians, stopping you outside your house, asking you for ID, pat-downs, you know, searches, raids in the middle of the night, it's an obvious way where there are human rights violations, and that has been going on, creating a tremendous resentment, and there is no accountability. The military forces have almost virtual immunity from prosecution. So women are raped, people are disappeared, people are killed, they're wounded, and nothing happens to the security forces. Why? Because they say, well, these are terrorists. They're aligned with Pakistan. Now, Pakistan in the Indian context is the boogeyman, the bad state that does evil things. And on top of that, they say, well, they're Taliban, they're aligned with Al-Qaeda. And this fits perfectly into the U.S. narrative of black and white. You know, you're either with us or with against us. So the U.S. does not push India on human rights violations and its continued, you know, atrocities.
Nor do the New York Times or the Washington Post. I mean, maybe I missed something, but I don't think they're covering it all that much.
There's very little attention paid to Kashmir, and I think it's going to be very much in the news in the coming years. Watch for this summer in particular, when people are now planning for a major uprising. You know, the interesting thing about Kashmir, it was Tahrir Square before Tahrir Square. 1 million Kashmiris turned out in a place called Eidgah, right outside of Srinagar, a vast open area, and there's a famous mosque there as well. 1 million people. Nobody knows about it. I've mentioned that to people here. No one knows about it.
Yeah.
Everyone knows about Tahrir Square. Again, it's not the right narrative. It's Muslims using nonviolence and civil disobedience against an allied state, which is New Delhi.
Now, you were talking about how there's more use of non-cooperation and civil disobedience. What does that look like?
Well, before, there was the romance of the gun, just as in the Palestinian movement, particularly in the first Intifada. There was the kind of, you had this in a lot of the post-colonial states and movements, the romance of armed struggle. we're going to seize power. We've got the AK-47. We're going to bring down the state by force. Well, that plays perfectly into the hands of the state's most powerful suit, which is force. They have a monopoly on violence.
Right.
They want to encourage people to use armed force in their resistance rather than civil disobedience. By the use of civil disobedience, the Kashmiris and others seize the moral high ground from the oppressor. And then the burden, the onus then becomes placed on the oppressor. So that change has occurred over the last 3 or 4 years. And again, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube have been important instruments in unifying opposition to Indian rule. And just to give you an idea of what Kashmir looks like, it's a crisscross. The valley is a grid of camps and interrogation centers and checkpoints and guard posts and watchtowers. You could be stopped at any moment. You don't know, you know, if you're going to be shot. As I said, the troops have virtual immunity. They can say anyone is a militant, a suspected militant, like all of the, you know, many of the people killed in Pakistan and Afghanistan today are always described as suspected militants.
So were you going there blending in, or, I mean, how did you get stopped by people, by security forces?
Well, when you enter Srinagar Airport, Srinagar is the capital of Kashmir, you feel like you're entering a foreign country. You have to fill out a special form. This is ostensibly a part of the Indian Union.
Right, you should be able to drive in.
Yes, you have to fill out a special form. They want to know where you're going, where you're staying, who you're seeing, and the like. And I was doing some, you know, investigations there, interviews, following up on my previous visit, how things had changed, how they have evolved since 2007. So I'm convinced that this is going to be a very, very big story in the coming months.
Because how does it relate to the revolutions that are going on in Egypt and in the rest of the Middle East?
Well, they do relate in terms of fighting oppression, but fundamentally, Kashmir differs in that it is a struggle for independence from the Indian state, whereas in Iran or Tunisia or Egypt, people are calling for a change in the regime. They're not calling for separation from the state and creating another state. So in that way, there's a fundamental difference. They have in commonality the fact that they are Muslim, but the struggle in Kashmir is largely secular, as it has been in much of the Middle East, much to the maybe distress of the U.S., which likes to present things as a kind of, you know, everything within the Islamic paradigm, that this, you know, there's so much worry. There was when the Egyptian revolt started, the New York Times was full of articles about, you know, will this be an Islamic revolution? Will it be another Iran? Iran being a code word for something very, very unwelcome and not desirable. So these different revolutions, in fact, Egypt was inspired by Kashmir to some extent, because Kashmiris were involved in the Palestine issue as well, and they were sending things out on Facebook in 2, 3, 4 years ago that were picked. That these things were picked up in Egypt, and they started creating sites using the new technology. So this has all been, I think, kind of interconnected. It's there's tremendous potential here for social change in a positive way.
You were saying that they'd kind of gotten over the romance of the gun and were now doing other kinds of activities. I mean, what does the resistance look like? What did you see?
Well, you see civil disobedience. You see boycotts. You see just street demonstrations where mostly young people, a lot of students, you know, are confronting the state security forces, expressing their right to demonstrate, which, you know, Obama and others has said is sacrosanct. But again, when it comes to Kashmir, Washington is very carefully censors itself and bleeps out things that may cause distress to New Delhi because of the things I mentioned earlier. It sees India as a major, not just economic partner, but soon to be military ally.
What is Kashmir like culturally, linguistically?
It's extraordinary in terms of beauty. The 17th century Mughal emperor, his name was Jahangir, and used a Persian couplet. He said, "Agar Ferdus Berue Zaminast, Haministo, Haministo, Haministo." If there is heaven on earth, it is this, it is this, it is this. The valley is surrounded by the Himalayas. Just spectacular lakes and rivers. It's lush. They have these chinar trees all over, which I think is like a poplar. I'm not sure about that. Very, very beautiful. It has deep influences from Iran and Central Asia. You see the architecture, and you see a lot of similarities to Central Asia. You don't see that the typical, let's say, Indian Mughal or a Pakistani architecture. Its language there is it's Indo-European, but the official language of the state is Urdu, but Kashmiri is its own language. And I can make out words, but I can't quite get it.
Right.
It's very rich culturally. They have a musical system of their own called Sufiana Kalam, which is the music of the Sufis, because there's a Sufi tradition as well, Sufism being the mystical, esoteric dimension of Islam.
Now, are there resource issues there that makes India not want to give them independence? In other words, we just did, for example, a show about Tibet, and of course, just the land and water issues alone there are enough to make China want to have very tight control over it. What about Kashmir?
Water is the major issue, because the Himalayas, the source of the major rivers in India and crucially in Pakistan, the Indus and the Jhelum, have their source in Kashmir. But that's not the whole story. This is a very emotional issue for India and for most Indians in terms of Kashmir. It's seen as some kind of a pristine place, a center of old Hindu scholarship and learning. It was Hindu until the 14th century when the population converted to Islam. So Kashmir occupies a very large space in the Indian imagination, and they don't want to easily let go of it. And the propaganda, they too have a corporate media, is that, you know, these are terrorists, these are miscreants, as they say in Indian English, who have no legitimate cause to rebel against New Delhi.
We're talking to David Barsamyan. If you were only to watch United States TV news, excluding Democracy Now!, you would get the idea that popular democratic movements and Islam were mutually exclusive by definition. A re-release of the book The Pen and the Sword, which is conversations between you and the Palestinian thinker Edward Said. And it's fascinating because this book was put together about 20 years ago, and so much of it is still very current. I don't know whether you guys were prescient or whether the issues just haven't changed or what, but give us some clarification about Islamic democratic movements.
Well, let me talk a little bit about Edward Said, a great Columbia University scholar and intellectual, who put his knowledge at the service of people's organizations rather than state power. He's what Gramsci called an organic intellectual. And the issues that Said was focusing, issues that Said focused on in The Pen and the Sword and elsewhere as well, are as valid today as they were 20, 25 years ago. We did our first interview in 1987. I remember it like it was yesterday in his office at Columbia University. He was talking about the pathology of post-colonial states, states that had detached themselves from imperial power, but who perpetuated the very structures of imperial power. So they had become, in the words of Frantz Fanon, who was from Martinique and wrote Wretched of the Earth, and who was very active in Algeria in the movement to oust the French from Algeria, he said, "We don't want to replace white policemen with brown or black ones." And that has happened in Algeria. It happened in Egypt, it happened in state after state. that detached itself from European empire. And crucially, as Said and others have pointed out, Iqbal Ahmed, who was one of his mentors, there was an intellectual collaborator class in every single one of these countries that carried out programs and policies that ultimately benefited the previous empire. So in Italy, in Libya, you had Italy. In France, in Algeria, and Tunisia, and in Morocco. The British in Egypt. In country after country, a collaborator class replaced the old ruling class. And Fanon and others warned about this. And so Said talks about this. He also talked about the corruption of the Palestinian leadership. This is 20, 25 years ago. And he broke with Arafat over his policies. He thought they were extremely deleterious to Palestinian liberation. And he was warning then that ultimately there could be no independent, viable Palestinian state as long as this Israeli project of colonization, of settlement building, continued unabated. Here we are, almost 20 years after Oslo, with now 500 to 600,000 settlers in the occupied West Bank, who show no signs of moving, who Washington seems to support in a myriad of ways, largely through tax breaks, incidentally, to American taxpayers, as well as direct aid to Israel. So a lot of the issues that Said talked about are very, very valid today, and I hope people pick up the book.
The Pen and the Sword, will you have that tonight at the CCA?
Absolutely, and you know, happy to sign the copies.
Go back for a second to the question of Islam and democracy.
The Western intellectual class, the media pundits, have posited for decades that somehow Islam was not compatible with democracy, that
right.
It could not be reconciled with what we consider a democracy. By the way, democracy is not simply elections. Democracy should be much more than just turning out every 4 years and voting for this or that candidate, and then you go home and watch sitcoms and reruns of Law and Order and Sex and the City. It has to have some real meaning in terms of economic justice, which is sorely lacking. But the recent upheavals in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Oman, in other parts of the Arab Middle East, of course, in Libya as well, give the lie that somehow Muslims cannot aspire to, you know, the same vaunted values that Americans and others uphold. This is all part of this reductionist intellectual formulation of who Muslims are and what Islam is. It's very it's very simplistic. It's very erroneous. Islam is a very complicated religion. There's a vast tapestry of Muslim cultures from the southern Philippines to the Atlas Mountains in Morocco. So there's very little, you know, there's a lot of difference there. There's a tremendous amount of diversity. So when people talk about, you know, Islam this, Islam that, I kind of get a little wary of that kind of...
Yeah, that's why I was asking that, because, I mean, in any group, there's political diversity, there's liberals and conservatives and monarchists and everything else, and to lump them all together and say these, it's sort of like those people are incapable of democracy.
You'll notice that Christianity is never talked about in this
right.
in this way. So when 9/11 happens, there becomes an urgent connection between Islam and terrorism and violence and the Quran and Muslims and Arabs in particular. But what about Western Christian violence? What is its record in the 20th century? We don't have to go very far back into history or even today.
Yeah, or the Inquisition or the entire history of Christianity in the native, well, in the Americas. But guess what, David Barsamyan, we're out of time. We're just about out of time. So you will be speaking tonight at the CCA on revolutions in the Middle East and South Asia. David Barsamyan's website is alternativeradio.org. And so what are you working on now? You're still traveling all over the world.
Yeah, I'm going to do another book with Arundhati Roy. Our first book was Checkbook and the Cruise Missile. And
right.
I'm thinking about doing a book on Kashmir.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to that. And thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.